All set? Good. All right. Well, today we continue our study of Paul's letter to the Philippians, which we began last Sunday. And I noted that this would be an eight-part series. We'll finish up, Lord willing, on the Sunday before Easter. And so after today, we will only have six more weeks to go. How's that? All right. Now, it's not really my plan to spend a lot of time each week in this series reviewing what we've previously covered. And so as just a friendly reminder, yet again, if you miss a Sunday, please take advantage of the website or any of our number of podcast services so that you can be caught up to speed. Though we covered quite a bit of background material last week, one thing we didn't give a lot of attention to was the occasion itself, why the letter was written, what prompted Paul to write it. So this morning we want to start with that. And this will be something that we'll be actually talking about as we work through it. But here, kind of in our introduction for this morning, we could probably sum it up like this. Epaphroditus, one of the leaders at the church at Philippi, had been sent to Paul to provide him some support and encouragement while he was in prison. And during that visit, Paul is quite eager to hear about all that is going on in what is probably his favorite church, the church there at Philippi. And likewise, the Philippians are eager to hear how Paul is doing when Epaphroditus returns. And they are quite concerned about him. And so he prepares a letter to send back with Epaphroditus, this letter, to be read to the church there. Paul uses the opportunity to express several things in this letter. He fills them in about his own circumstances there in prison. He warmly conveys his love for them. They, as you will remember from last week, they had a very friendly, warm relationship with each other. He expresses appreciation for their gifts, prayers, and all their faithful support. He encourages them to endure persecution. He also warns them about false teachers who were promoting legalism. He gets on them a little bit about the need to pursue humility and unity. And he singles out two prominent women in that church who were in some sort of a squabble with each other. He calls them to extend honor and appreciation to Epaphroditus, who was a faithful and treasured servant of the Lord who had risked his life for the work of Christ because he almost died from a severe illness while they're helping Paul. And he tells them that once he knows the outcome of his trial, which is kind of looming over him there, he will send Timothy to them with the news, and that he himself hopes to pay them another visit at some point. So as you can see, there is not one particular reason for the letter, but several. He had a variety of things he wanted to tell them, and this visit of Epaphroditus provided an opportunity to pass all that on to them. And unlike many of his other letters, this one is not preoccupied with addressing problems. Only a couple are mentioned, and then only briefly. There are no great heresies, no corrections on how they're, you know, messing things up, no weighty concerns about in-house factions, certainly no scolding of any kind. We have this picture kind of Epaphroditus getting ready to return back to Philippi, and Paul, there through the prison bars, kind of grabs his arm as he starts to head out and says, hey, wait just a minute. I've been working on a letter for you to take back to them. It's almost ready. Another matter that we didn't talk about last Sunday is the structure of the letter itself, how to follow Paul's overall train of thought. Now, because this letter is more personal and informal, as we talked about last week, and not instructional, it is what we would expect for something like that. It's not going to be tightly organized. In some of his other letters, Paul, as you will remember, will start out with theology, like in the first half, and then he turns his focus to application in the second half. But here in Philippians, which is more like a letter from one friend to another, he mingles theology and application together. And he seems to have four primary sections. If we were to divide it, we might come up with maybe four. So we'll take a quick look at those. And if you have your Bibles, this would be a good time maybe to open them up and follow along. In the first section, verses 1 through 26, he explains his situation at Rome. And not knowing the outcome of it, he simply tells his readers that whatever happens, his goal is that Christ would be glorified. In the second section, verse 27 to 2:18, goes across the chapter there, he exhorts them to conduct themselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, namely, endure hardship and persecution, and strive for brotherly love and unity. And this he does by reminding them of the example of Christ. If they were adopt their Savior's humility and obedience, then they will become blameless and pure, true children of God. In the third section, which is basically chapter 3, Paul warns the church to be alert to certain Jewish legalists who will try to preoccupy them with circumcision and other religious rituals. Paul counters this with a forceful teaching about justification by faith and goes on to show that he had once trusted in these external forms of legalism and found the whole thing lacking. He even takes the liberty to compare that way of life to a vulgar term of that day to vividly emphasize just how worthless that approach to the faith really is. This is a powerful section, and we'll be spending a couple weeks in that chapter once we get there. In the last section, chapter 4, basically, Paul concludes with some final exhortations, mostly dealing with finding peace in God and rejoicing in his goodness. And he goes on to express again his appreciation for their support and encourages them as fellow partners in the spread of the gospel. So this morning we will be covering verse 12 of chapter 1 down to the end of the chapter. We'll be picking up where we left off the last time. And as we read it, we will come across two of the four opponents of either Paul or of the gospel that are mentioned in this letter. And so a few comments are in order about each of them before we dive into the text itself. In verses 15 through 17, we find certain preachers who are trying to stir up trouble for Paul. Now, he doesn't accuse them of false teaching, and along that line, they are not Judaizers, one of those groups who try to impose Jewish customs on new Christians. We don't really know anything about these preachers or what they are up to, but according to Paul, they preach out of envy, rivalry, selfish ambition, and they are divisive. Their motives, he says, are false. They oppose him personally, but they are not really enemies of the gospel per se. For what they preach, Paul actually agrees with. In fact, he is glad for their preaching. In verses 28 through 30, we find another set of opponents. Paul mentions those who are trying to intimidate the Christians in Philippi, causing them no small degree of suffering. Most likely, these are Roman authorities or Roman citizens who, for whatever reason, are wanting to silence the gospel and are prepared to use force to do so. And then later in chapter 3, we have some form of Judaizers, those who insist that Christians follow Jewish rituals, especially circumcision. Paul is especially agitated with them, for what they teach is a direct attack upon the core teaching of salvation by faith. And what they promote actually minimizes the efficacy or the power of Christ's atonement. And these Judaizers get access to churches because they claim to be Christians. And the church at Philippi is not the only one they had wormed their way into. And finally, later on in chapter 3, we have those who have been given into the pressure of their culture and live as enemies of the cross. It appears that they profess to be Christians, but their minds are on earthly things. Their God is not the Lord above, but rather their own selfish appetites. They are enemies of the cross because their lives contradict the true message of the cross. So, said all that to say this, once we plug these various opponents and enemies into what we already know from last week about Paul's relationship with his church and reasons for his letter, we get kind of a fuller picture here of what's going on at that church and some of his concerns. But again, none of these threats here really appear, at least at this point, to be too serious. All right, so let's go ahead and read through today's passage. We'll start with verse 12 and follow with me, if you would, as I read through it. My translation may be worded slightly different. I'm using the 1984 NIV, but the content itself is going to be pretty much the same. There aren't any serious textual issues here in this. Verse 12, "Now I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. Because of my chains, most of the brothers in the Lord have been encouraged to speak the word of God more courageously and fearlessly. It is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so in love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing that they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of this, I rejoice. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help given by the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far, but it is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain, and I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, so that through my being with you again, your joy in Christ Jesus will overflow on account of me. Whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then, whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, contending as one man for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ to not only believe on him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. All right, a lot here. As mentioned last Sunday, we will not be taking time in this particular series to squeeze all that we can out of every single verse. This is a long section. We would need several hours to do that. So the plan, again, is to get a basic grasp on what's going on in the whole passage and then consider more closely key verses and anything that might need a little more explanation. And along that line, I might add that as we work through a book, when we work through a book in the Bible, I often don't take a lot of time to point out every possible application. I'm assuming that the applications are going to be pretty obvious here, and I'm aware of the fact that different points will resonate with each of us differently. The various ways of application are as diverse as the number of people in this room. But sometimes we'll stop to point some things out nonetheless. So Paul begins this section by speaking candidly about his current situation. He is in prison. And he goes on to tell them of how his imprisonment is causing mixed reactions in the church at large. Rather than give details of his hardships, I mean, that would be me. There'd be 8 pages added to this letter of all the hardships I'd be going through. Paul doesn't do that. He doesn't give details of the hardships. He instead expresses joy that his imprisonment is causing the gospel to go forward. The believers at Philippi, again, true close friends of his, were obviously concerned about him, and that is why they sent Epaphroditus. And no doubt his imprisonment and impending trial was seen as a huge setback. Like, what's happened? What's going on? This is horrible. And they have been quite worried for both him and the mission. And so Paul's response was probably not what they were expecting. The mission has not been hindered, he tells them. Rather, it is advancing. He then describes 3 ways in which this has happened. First, as he notes, the word has gone out among the palace guard and beyond that I am not an ordinary prisoner. My situation is quite unusual, and so I am the talk of town. Who would have guessed? As a result, I've been given considerable opportunities to explain why I am in chains. Many are intrigued, fascinated, and eager to learn more about this Christ whom I serve and suffer for. So, Paul may be bound in chains, but obviously the gospel, on the other hand, has enjoyed remarkable freedom and is spreading like crazy. Secondly, the gospel has been advanced because his example of suffering for Christ has emboldened others to preach Christ more daringly. Those who were once timid have become more fearless. Examples of courage inspire us. We can all relate to this. I remember quite vividly watching a video almost 40 years ago of someone who walked into an abortion clinic in Birmingham, New York, telling the staff, "No babies will be killed today," and he walked back to the procedure room and then chained himself to the abortion table. I knew the guy, and I was just amazed at his courage when I saw the video. So the police came, and after several hours, they hauled him off to jail. Now, I've never done that. I've never even considered doing anything like that. But his example did indeed cause me to step up my efforts from that of just holding a sign outside the clinic. The cause is worth suffering for, and if others are suffering for it, then so should I. And the same is true for the gospel itself, so much more so. Thirdly, because of his imprisonment, Paul finds encouragement in the fact that the gospel has been advanced, strangely enough, through the preaching of his rivals, his opponents. Now, again, we don't have a good grasp of what's behind all of this, but apparently there are those who are wanting to stir things up to make it worse for Paul. And they have found that preaching the gospel that Paul preaches is doing that. So again, we don't really know, but the gospel message itself was offensive to Roman authorities. And if that was the case, then perhaps their preaching of it would force the Romans to come down on Paul even harder. That seems to be the case. Whatever the case, he simply notes that though they preach out of envy and rivalry with selfish motives, at the end of the day, what they preach is true. What they preach is Christ. And for that, he is not only content, but delighted. His exact words, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached. And because of this, together, I rejoice. All right, you guys are like a bunch of Episcopalians out here. We got to get more interaction going. Because of this, I
rejoice.
There you go. All right. As we move into the last part of verse 18, Paul turns his attention to the future. He not only rejoices to see God work in his present circumstances to advance the gospel, but he will continue to rejoice in God's faithfulness in whatever awaits him. On one level, the future is uncertain. The trial is hanging over his head. The outcome could be anything from freedom to death. On another level, the future is very certain, entirely certain. He knows that whether by life or death, Christ will be exalted. Either way, acquittal or execution, he will not, while he waits for the outcome, be deprived of joy. This is remarkable. Verses 19 and 25, however, indicate that he is pretty optimistic that he will be acquitted. He is hopeful about seeing them again soon so as to help them progress in the faith and to continue the mission of spreading the gospel to the Gentiles. But yet, as he also knows, the matter is completely out of his hands. In his own mind, he resolves this agonizing tension between life and death by committing himself to serve to the end, whatever that would be and however that would come about. So let's take note again of what he actually says. Now as always, now as always, what words? Third verse 20, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. And the next words, very familiar, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Now normally, when you kind of just step back and look at this, one would tend to say to live is gain and to die is Christ. I mean, that is how we actually are conditioned to think. You know, if I am suffering a life-threatening sickness or injury, it is a great advantage, great profit for me to pull through and survive it. To live is gain. If, on the other hand, I die, then I go to be with the Lord. Thus, to die is Christ. Yet Paul reverses this. In fact, to live is Christ is magnified by the statement, to die is gain. So let's think about this for a moment and see if we can better appreciate his point in these two verses. Paul often spoke of Christ as his life. We find statements like that in some of his other letters. Essentially, what this means is that he so wanted to glorify Christ that as long as he lived, everything about him would be to please him and fulfill his will. Take, for instance, Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. In our letter here, that particular truth or conviction is accomplished at least in part by his chains in prison. Again, he is resolved to serve the Lord to the very end. And when that end comes, death, though it is the great enemy, and though it will prevent him from spreading the gospel to the Gentiles and helping the Philippians progress in the faith, it will still be a gain, at least in some sense, for he will be with the Lord in a more intimate way and will enjoy rest from enduring the difficulties he was called to bear on earth. Now, English translations do not really capture the rhetorical power of these words. There are no verbs. To live, Christ. To die, gain. The rhythm is striking, and it's intentional. The verb could be filled in different ways, and we find variations of this actually in different translations. To live is Christ. That's the traditional translation. It could also be to live means Christ, or to live depends on Christ, or to live honors Christ. Whatever the case, the obvious point Paul is making is that his foundation, center, purpose, direction, power, and meaning of life is Christ. Since Christ is the goal of life, dying is gain, if it is a way of bearing witness to Christ. All right? Let me repeat that. Since Christ is the goal of life, dying is gain if it is a way of bearing witness to Christ. So, very important. Verse 21 needs to be read in the light of verse 20, where Paul says that Christ will be exalted in him, whether by life or death. Verse 20 informs the way that we are to understand verse 21. Following me so far? This means that the words to die and gain is not exclusively referring to what Paul himself would gain in his death, but also on what the gospel of Christ would gain, on how Christ would be exalted. Namely, the advancement of the gospel that would result from his martyrdom. If his imprisonment has expanded the message of Christ, then how much more so would his death? We would expect it to accelerate, given a whole new depth of significance. Its worth in the eyes of others greatly elevated. He was willing to die for this? What's this all about? As we know from church history, this is exactly what does happen. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Though Paul's letter is not a manual on martyrdom or promoting martyrdom, his words here have actually provided encouragement and inspiration for many facing a martyr's death. For us, who are not yet facing martyrdom, the main takeaway is that these popular words, to die as gain, are to be understood in their context. This is very important. Let us not draw from them any conclusion that would minimize the present life, and that death is a welcome friend that releases us from it. This is often the case you hear in many funeral messages, for instance. To conclude that is to, in reality, I mean, look at this. To conclude that is to gut the truth out of the previous words, to live is Christ. This life is not a dreadful thing, a curse, if living it is for the glory of Christ. Right? Everyone with me so far? All right, let's move on. I'll be passing out a test on this at some point, so just don't go through the motions here. If I get back from South Bend. You're going to come up. I know. Bring your checkbook. All right. We should have a plan B just in case, though. Moving on to a quick observation from verse 25. Here Paul says, in his hope that he will be released, that I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith. I love those words. Last week I pointed out the words pray and joy from verse 4. Here we have joy in the faith. These expressions, which are easy to overlook, are pretty impactful once you spot them. Some form of the words joy or rejoice occur in this letter 16 times, and they don't always stand out. So as you read through it this week, read through this letter, you might want to be on the lookout for them. All right, moving on to verses 27 through 30. I love the opening words of this next paragraph here. Whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. What a mission statement. And they help capture the meaning of to live as Christ. To Paul, the whatever happens is, of course, referring to the outcome of his impending trial in the Roman court. But you and I could apply these words universally to virtually anything we face, from the nitty-gritty grind of daily life to, if the day were to come, the threat of martyrdom. Those two words completely, you know, whatever happens, those two words completely neutralize any excuse we might come up with when trying to justify some sort of compromise or, for that matter, even sin. There is no reason that we can't, in whatever happens, you know, really wonderful things or really crappy things, conduct ourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel. This is the whole point of the previous three paragraphs. Now, if you remember the way I outlined this letter at the beginning of today's message, you might recall that this paragraph here, starting in verse 27, begins the second major section of the letter, which runs all the way down to verse 18 of chapter 2. In this section, Paul offers some tangible ways for them to conduct themselves in a worthy manner. And he begins by exhorting them to remain steadfast in the midst of persecution. And then, as we head into the next chapter, he turns his attention to their attitudes toward each other. So here in our verses for now, 27 through 30, the focus is on standing together against outside opposition. So let's think about that now. Paul actually compares his own struggle with the Romans to their struggle with the Romans. His exhortations here seem to actually draw from teachings of Jesus, who promised that all who followed him would suffer opposition and hardship. Josh mentioned that earlier today in the persecution report. And Jesus mentioned that persecution really is a cause for blessing and rejoicing. Now, the word stand there in verse 27 is a military word. It's a military metaphor. It provides a picture of resisting an approaching army, of holding the fort. Soldiers will be able to do that if they work together as a unit, as a team. And this is exactly what Paul calls his readers to do. Stand firm in one spirit, continue as one man for the faith of the gospel. So whether one is holding firm in the face of persecution or advancing forward in the spread of the good news, opposition is to be expected, and that opposition will inevitably be unpleasant. And so Paul speaks candidly about Christian suffering. But yet he presents it here, given the tone of this letter, we would expect that. He presents it here as a privilege, telling his readers that it has been granted to them, to us, on behalf of Christ, to not only believe in him, but also to suffer for him. It is, in a strange kind of way, but true nonetheless, a gift. Now, it is one thing to accept suffering and resign oneself to it. It is another to realize the privileges that come through it. And here I'm talking about suffering for the cause of Christ. On this, we might think of the apostles back in Acts 5, where they were flogged for proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus. Afterwards, it says that they left, quote, rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. In both believing and suffering, Christ is the source and center of life. And we need to remember that suffering in general, it comes from living in a fallen world, a world itself suffering from the effects of sin. Yet, Christians, because of their identification with righteousness in a world that is hostile to righteousness, will suffer a unique kind of suffering. And this suffering, as Jesus stated in the Beatitudes, is a divinely given privilege, a blessing. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven indeed. It is a blessing to be involved in the battle, and the struggle itself in this battle can be quite redemptive. From all we've looked at today, one thing we can say for certain, suffering for righteousness is a way to not only advance the gospel itself, but also for a way for Christ to be glorified. Again, those words of Paul, so that now as always, Christ may be exalted in me, whether by life or by suffering or by death itself. So in conclusion, Paul closes the paragraph by connecting his suffering and the fruit that it bears to theirs in expectation that it too will bear fruit. They had seen the hardship Paul endured for the sake of the gospel when he first came to Philippi. You may remember from last week, he and Silas had been stripped, beaten, and jailed there at Philippi for throwing the whole town in an uproar over the power of Christ's message. Now, some 10 years later, he is jailed again, this time in Rome, and again for the sake of the gospel. And so in this, Paul encourages them with a perspective that perhaps they had not thought of. He tells them that their suffering and his are part of the same struggle to advance the cause of Christ. He may be suffering more intensely and the threat to his life greater, but in the end, whoever takes a stand for Christ is honoring him just the same. And if you and I suffer for the cause of Christ, we share with them as well, with Paul and the Philippians, and for that matter, for all the saints through history. Their struggle is our struggle, all for the glory of God. Just as Paul was more concerned about the advancement of the gospel than his own imprisonment, and just as he was more concerned about Christ being preached than the malicious motives of those who preached it, and just as he was more concerned about Christ being magnified than whether he lived or died, so the Philippian Christians, he tells them, should concern themselves more with conduct that is worthy of the gospel than with cowering back in fear to the threats of others. And the application is clear. So should we. If we could title verses 27 through 30 as standing united against opposition from the outside, the next four verses, starting in chapter 2, could be titled standing united against dissension from within. And that's where we will pick it up next Sunday. We'll cover verses 1 through 18 of chapter 2. So I will encourage you to read ahead and be prepared for that. So we have a little time. Are there any questions from anything that was covered this morning? We need a little Jeopardy tune going on right now. All right, so I'll have the musicians come. We'll stand, and we're going to close with an appropriate three verses from an appropriate song for all the saints.